Everyone, and thank you for attending today's call, the DOL to SEC and the State Fiduciary Law Developments Conference call. If at any time you require operator assistance, please key star zero and an operator will be more than happy to assist you. A recording of this call will be emailed to you as the follow-up and will be posted to stradley.com as well. And now I would like to turn the call over to George Gerstein. Please proceed.
Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for this briefing on DOL, SEC, and state developments in the fiduciary space. It's been a very active and uncertain time indeed, and we thought the time was right to get everyone up to speed. In terms of agenda and format, we'll start with some political developments, namely the recent nomination of Preston Rutledge and what that means for the DOL fiduciary rule. We'll also discuss the introduction of the PATH Act in the House. We'll then turn to what we're hearing out of the SEC and what we can expect from them. From there, we'll transition to what we're seeing out of Nevada and several other states in terms of the imposition of their own fiduciary duties on broker-dealers and advisors. We'll round out the briefing by discussing the latest on the DOL fiduciary rule and what firms should be thinking about during this transition period. We hope you'll stick around for the full session, which we think should take no more than 45 minutes. Please note that this is not a Q&A format, so if you have specific questions or comments for Larry or me, please feel free to reach out to us directly. Finally, a recording of this briefing, along with a brief written summary, will be circulated in the coming days. By way of quick introductions, my name is George Gerstein, and I'm ERISA counsel at Stradley Ronan within the investment management group. I, along with my colleague Jim Podhizer, routinely advise a wide range of clients on ERISA compliance, including the fiduciary rule. We also advise on non-ERISA fiduciary issues, such as OCC Reg 9 and the rules applicable to governmental plans. I'm here with my colleague Larry Sedulis, who will introduce himself.
Hi, my name is Larry Sedulis, and I'm a member of our investment management practice group here at Stradley Ronan. I practice in the advisor and broker-dealer areas primarily, and I co-head our investment advisor practice and lead our broker-dealer practice area.
Yeah, Larry and I collaborate quite a bit because the standards of care applicable to retirement versus non-retirement investors can be quite interrelated. For this reason, we've developed a working group on federal and state fiduciary laws, collaborative group analyzing the rules and standards applicable to advisors, broker-dealers, banks, and others, vis-a-vis retirement and non-retirement investors. We think our experience, along with John Baker, who is one of our experts in OCC rules, and other colleagues of ours in our new working group, collectively covers the winterfront, and we're proud of that fact. So let's start with recent political developments. On Friday, the President nominated Preston Rutledge to be an Assistant Secretary of Labor for the Division of Labor that is overseeing the fiduciary rule. To put this nomination into context, the Assistant Secretary could have an enormous impact on the trajectory of the DOL's reexamination of the fiduciary rule. It's a political appointee, and so in terms of carrying out the wishes of the White House, the secretary and assistant secretary would help guide the staff in terms of that. The prior assistant secretary, Phil Sporzy, who was very influential over the 2010 fiduciary proposal. However, depending on the rulemaking, the secretary may have much more influence than the assistant secretary. And the 2015 and 2016 versions of the fiduciary rule are examples of that. So, it's anyone's guess whether Preston Rutledge will have an immediate and significant influence on the DOL's reexamination of the rule. The DOL has been reconsidering the rule since February, when the President issued his executive action. So one would think that at least some strategic decisions have already been made, such as a new class exemption, which the DOL recently announced was in the works. By way of a quick background on this nominee, he served as senior tax and benefits counsel on the majority tax staff of the Senate Finance Committee. Prior to joining the Senate Finance Committee, he served on the staff of the Tax Exempt and Government Entities Division of the Internal Revenue Service. He also worked in the IRS Office of Chief Counsel and in private law practice as an employee benefits counselor and ERISA litigator. He is subject to confirmation, though by reason of his experience on the Senate Finance Committee, you may have a smoother confirmation of other nominees. The second political development is Representative Ann Wagner's introduction of the PATH Act. It recently cleared the House Financial Services Committee and will be voted upon by the House. Though the headline for the legislation is that it would repeal the DOL fiduciary rule, there are other aspects of it to consider. To explain the legislation, let me hand things over to Larry.
Sure. Thanks, George. The PATH Act was introduced by Representative Wagner on September 27th of this year. The act would require broker-dealers to make recommendations to retail customers that are in their, quote, best interest at the time of the recommendation using reasonable diligence and care. Essentially, the provision follows or is in line with FINRA Rule 2111, which is the suitability rule for broker-dealers. The PATH Act also requires point-of-sale disclosures by broker-dealers of the following: the types and scope of the services provided, the standard of conduct applicable to their relationship with the customer, retail customer, the types of compensation that will be received, and any material conflicts of interest. The bill does not require broker-dealers to avoid or eliminate all conflicts of interest, but rather to avoid or disclose them. And for purposes of this requirement, receipt of transaction-based compensation is not prohibited, nor and there's no need to recommend the least expensive product. In other words, there's no requirement to recommend the least expensive product in order to meet the best interest standard that we're talking about here. The Act or the bill does not create any presumption of fiduciary status under the Advisors Act or ERISA or under the tax code. So as you can see, it's not drafted as a fiduciary standard, but rather a best interest standard. It preempts state law, and it would prohibit the DOL from imposing duplicative or additional requirements on broker dealers in addition to those in the PATH Act itself. So the PATH Act, in short, in essence, is a statutory codification for the most part of the existing this is a codification of the existing FINRA suitability standard. George?
Yeah, one provision in particular that I found interesting in the PATH Act was, and you mentioned this, Larry, that it's the one about the fact that the best interest standard would not presumptively create fiduciary status under ERISA or other laws. Have you seen that sort of provision in other securities legislation in your experience?
I have not. It's like preemption, advanced preemption of preemption. I've not seen a similar provision. The idea here, obviously, would be to limit the standard of that applies to broker dealers to this particular standard, and would not authorize DOL to deviate from it.
Got it. All right. Another big development of late is what appears to be genuine interest on the part of the SEC to finally put forth a uniform fiduciary standard as contemplated under Dodd-Frank. Jay Clayton, the chairman, has testified before both the Senate Banking Committee and the House Financial Services Committee over the past few weeks, and he's confirmed that staff are working on a standard of care and that a new rule, along with coordination with the DOL, is a top priority for him. This, of course, is on the heels of the SEC's issuance of an RFI in early summer, asking for the public to comment on what a new standard should look like, as well as their opinions on the DOL rule. Chairman Clayton confirmed they are still reviewing those responses. Larry, is there anything we should add here on what the SEC is doing?
Well, what else should we learn, George? We're not privy to what's going on at the SEC. We do know that Chairman Clayton did say that what the PATH Act was getting at, that he was sensitive to and was thinking about. I believe he indicated during his hearings on October 4th that he was thinking along those lines or something to that effect. So the PATH Act is stuff, and what it's embodied in it is something at least that's on his radar. I think that it's way too premature for us to draw any definitive conclusions as to where the SEC is going to go on this and where it'll ultimately going to arrive at. I also think that it's going to take some time to work its way through the system.
Mm-hmm. All right. Chairman Clayton also confirmed that not only will the SEC coordinate with the DOL, but that the states will be participants in that discussion. Though that is not entirely unusual, it could be a nod to various developments at the state level that seek to impose fiduciary duties on broker-dealers and registered investment advisors. We'll go into each of those states, particularly Nevada, but by way of context, let me say that a number of states see the lack of a uniform standard by the SEC and expected changes to the DOL fiduciary rule as a basis for stepping in and imposing their own duties. This creates a truly dynamic situation, as state action appears to be a function of what happens at the federal level. Now, certain states are trying to shoehorn broker-dealers and RIAs into their financial planner statutes. These statutes were designed to address the confusion that retail investors have in terms of the multitudinous titles and designations, such as financial planner, and whether that type of role would owe a fiduciary duty to the investor. So that's what those statutes were originally designed for. But as we'll see, the states at this point are going in different directions in terms of applying those statutes to broker-dealers and advisors, which is causing a bit of a compliance quagmire. But let us pause here and state what perhaps could be the obvious. Is it any surprise that at least some states are stepping in, particularly as the DOL appears poised to ease the compliance burden in terms of the fiduciary rule? Since the election, some states have definitely become more assertive in a wide range of policy areas. Is there any reason why, politically, the states would not similarly step in terms of financial services? I don't, and I think the proof is in the pudding. Several states have at least introduced bills to regulate broker-dealers and RIAs. Others are reportedly in the wings, and depending on what the SEC and or the DOL does in the coming months, another cascade of states could follow. We see this as an emerging trend, and because of that, we've developed an internal working group, which I mentioned at the outset, to track both federal and state fiduciary law developments. Not to bore you on details, but we've eventually laid the foundation to detect, track, and analyze legislation that is introduced in any of the states that could implicate these issues. We're also tracking the eventual litigation. This is in response to client interest and that we're not aware of many other firms providing the service. So let's start with Nevada, Larry. Would you mind getting everyone up to speed on what's happening there and what you learned at the recent workshop hosted by the state securities regulator?
Sure, happy to. So Nevada law currently provides that a financial planner has the duty of a fiduciary towards a client. That's a requirement. And this includes the duty to disclose to a client at the time advice is given, any gain that a financial planner may receive, such as a profit or commission. A financial planner also has to make diligent inquiry of each client to ascertain initially and keep currently informed concerning the client's financial circumstances and obligations, and the client's present and anticipated obligations and goals for his or her family. So they just to summarize, that under Nevada law, any entity falling within the definition of financial planner has a fiduciary to clients. In addition to that, if there is a loss, if the client suffers a loss of a financial planner resulting from a breach of the fiduciary duty or from gross negligence, the client is entitled to recover the amount of that economic loss plus of any fees associated with the litigation. Financial planner is defined to include any person who, for compensation, advises others upon the investment of money or upon provision for income to be needed in the future, or who holds his or herself out as providing those services. Prior to July 1st, the definition of financial planner excluded broker-dealers and investment advisors. However, Senate Bill 383 was introduced on March 20th, passed on May 22nd, and signed by the governor of Nevada into law on June 2nd of 2017. It became effective on July 1st. So, the repeal of the exemption for broker-dealer and advisors from the definition of financial planners has been repealed and is no longer on the books. The Bill 383, which was enacted, it removes the exemption for broker-dealers and investment advisors. It also authorizes the state securities administrator to adopt rules defining or excluding an actor practice as violative of the fiduciary standard. It also authorizes the administrator to adopt rules designed to prevent broker-dealers and investment advisors from violating this standard. So in addition to repealing the exemption, the Nevada legislation gives the securities administrator broad authority to define what the duty of the fiduciary duty is, what the obligations are, and to adopt rules limiting or prescribing what conduct is prohibited. But again, the law has not, no rules have currently been adopted. However, notice was issued on September 8th by the securities administrator that a workshop would be held in Las Vegas on October 6th to solicit public comment on the legislation. And I attended I attended the workshop on October 6th in Las Vegas. It lasted about 2 hours, and there were about 25 to 35 attendees present. The constituency included broker-dealer and retirement plan-related trade associations, resident financial advisors associated with large brokerage firms, and at least one law school professor. A number of attendees submitted written comments, which currently aren't available online at Nevada's internet sites, so you sort of have to, some of them are available at the trade association sites, so you have to track them down that way. Most of the comments fall into the following categories where people gave testimony. First of all, any rulemaking should clarify that the fiduciary conduct standard applies only to those firms meeting the definition of financial planner, and this definition doesn't encompass all broker-dealers and advisors. When you look, as I read before, the definition of financial planner, it's fairly broad and unclear, but one area of comment is what is a financial planner, and it shouldn't encompass everybody. The second and probably the largest category of comments related to preemption arguments that the Nevada legislation is invalid and is preempted under federal securities laws applicable to advisors or broker-dealers, and is also inapplicable as a result of ERISA preemption of state law. There was also concerns over the requirement of, if you recall, about reading the fiduciary standard. There was concern about how to quantify a gain or financial planner may receive or profit. How do you quantify a gain or profit for disclosure purposes? And also about the breadth of the term financial planning, the requirement that you have to consider the financial condition of the family as a whole when financial planners often may provide financial planning services only to an individual without regard to family concerns. During the hearings, there was no guidance that was provided at all about the legislation's current application to advisors or brokers. No guidance was given on to how the statute applies to entities currently. Moreover, nothing was said about the details of the rulemaking process, where things stand, what the rule will look like, or any timetable. Simply that there would be another workshop scheduled, and that the comment period would remain open through the second workshop, and that meant by the comment period, people are invited to submit written comment. So Nevada is clearly aware, and by the way, Nevada is clearly aware of and familiar with the preemption arguments. It seemed from what was said that interest was primarily directed at whether and to what extent certain persons' activity should be exempted from the requirements, since they seem to have a good handle on the preemption arguments themselves. The upshot is that Nevada does not appear to be rushing towards a rulemaking in this area. Rather, they're taking a more measured approach, and they're seeking as much public input as possible, it appears, and waiting to see what federal regulators do in the area. As a result, we wouldn't expect the adoption of any rules in near term. The greatest unresolved issue, I think, at this time, and the one in need of the most immediate attention, is the impact of the legislation on advisors and brokers, even in the absence of rulemaking. Since the statute is effective as a technical matter, imposes a fiduciary duty, including disclosure of compensation on those firms. There's just no guidance out there, and that's sort of, I think, the 100-pound gorilla in the room right now, George.
Thank you, Larry. I had a couple of observations. I actually called the state and asked them specifically whether there'd be any recording or transcript of the workshop, and when they said no, I thought, oh, we should definitely have some presence out there, and Larry was kind enough to go out there and represent us. A couple of observations, and I actually have a couple of questions for Larry. What I think rather unfortunate about the whole Nevada situation is that I believe that the The bill was passed into law in June. It went into effect on July 1st. I do think this caught a lot of people by surprise. And not only was it did the effective date spring very quickly upon its passage, but it really was the skeleton of a framework. And there was very little guidance in terms of how folks were supposed to comply with it, which is rather unfortunate because, it would have been good if there were at least kind of like a non-enforcement policy perhaps during this interim period before the regulations came out. But to our knowledge, that has not been done yet. I would also mention that the comment period does remain open, as Larry mentioned, and the Nevada Securities Division does actually want comments on people's experience with the DOL fiduciary and what they think of it, similar to the SEC actually. So you can, if you are so inclined, you can actually draw upon your experience and provide comments on that. But those would be a couple of observations. Now, Larry, for you, what do you think we should look for in the upcoming Nevada regulations, assuming that those are ultimately promulgated?
Well, as I said, we really don't have any idea. I think the one flavor that kind of came across from all of this is that the Nevada legislature did pass this legislation, and therefore something needs to be done one way or the other. So we would expect something to come out from them. We're just not sure what that's going to be and how they're going to. I think that the key for them is trying to fit it into the many moving pieces around them, specifically what's going on at DOL, SEC, and at the other state level to try and come up with a mechanism that's workable and one that both is protective investors, but at the same time it does not penalize folks for doing business in their state.
Yeah, the early indications from the securities regulator in Nevada was, draft regulations in the early to mid-fall, so right around the workshop. It would have to go to another committee, and then ultimately become sort of finalized. That's how their process works, apparently. And the timetable for the regulations seems getting pushed back. I'm actually hearing it's going to not. We won't see any draft regulations for comment until even 2018, the early part of it. So we'll have to see. All right, one more question, Larry, on Nevada. Some of our listeners may be aware that a number of states historically had fiduciary duties imposed on broker-dealers. So why is Nevada's case so special?
Nevada's case is unique and is reflective of the trend right now. Historically, the fiduciary duty is derived from common law. Originally, it was derived from equity. What's unique about Nevada and about the PASS Act, for that matter, although it's not a fiduciary standard, is that it's a rules-based approach to setting a standard. In other words, it prescribes the specific nature of the obligation, in this case, that they are a fiduciary. It doesn't just say they're a fiduciary, but it also says that as a fiduciary, they must do the following, and then authorizes Nevada to the administrator to adopt rules. So what's unique about it is the fact, not that it's derived by case law, but rather it's a statutory and rule-based regime.
Got it. Thanks so much. So Nevada is clearly something we're watching carefully, but there are also other states that are jumping into the fray. Let's start with Massachusetts. It has the oldest of the bills, having been introduced in 2015. The bill requires a firm to indicate on a designated form whether it is acting as an investment advisor or broker-dealer, coupled with a brief description of what each role entails. The form would be provided to a client at the start of the relationship or upon any change in status, and it would need to be signed by both the client and the firm. Now, if a firm is acting as both an investment advisor and broker-dealer, then the firm would need to adhere to the fiduciary standard at all times and act in the best interest of the clients. The bill would also prohibit advisors from receiving conflicted remuneration, namely any benefit given to the firm that could reasonably be expected to influence the advice. As for the bill's status, well, the Committee on Financial Services is conducting a study on a series of issues, including this one, so I would suspect we won't see movement until that study is completed, but we'll keep you posted, of course. New York. According to the Wall Street Journal, New York Assemblyman Jeffrey Dinowitz started working on a fiduciary bill many years ago, but halted the effort when the Obama administration's Department of Labor promulgated its fiduciary rule. Perhaps not coincidentally, the Assemblyman introduced a new bill on January 20th, Inauguration Day, which would enhance the disclosure requirements on investment advisors currently not subject to a fiduciary standard under existing state and federal law, or by any applicable standard of professional conduct. The definition of non-fiduciary investment advisor includes persons and firms who identify themselves as brokers or dealers, along with many other designations. On this point, I would say that when I initially read the bill's text, I thought there was an argument that federally regulated broker-dealers would be exempted, though this does not seem to be what the bill contemplates, at least according to its accompanying explanatory memorandum. In addition to declaring that you are not a fiduciary, to the extent that investment advisors are subject to the fiduciary duty with respect to certain types of investment advice, but not others, then there must be disclosure on the extent to which the fiduciary duty does and does not apply. Although, query, if you have fiduciary status under the DOL rule, which is conditioned the function of what you actually do, and you may be actually unaware of your fiduciary status, how this would apply, you know, in practice. But anyway, the bill contemplates an effective date of January 1st, 2018, though we note that it's slowly working its way through the legislature, and it's currently sitting with the Committee on Codes. New Jersey's is very similar to New York's, and it's currently with the Senate Commerce Committee. A number of states have passed resolutions largely directed at the DOL, the SEC, and Congress regarding the fiduciary advice, investment advice standard, including California, Michigan, Illinois, and New Jersey. We note, however, that California has since moved its resolution to inactive status. I think you can now see many of the moving parts. Consider whether these states will recede or others will jump in if and when the DOL proposes a revised fiduciary rule. It's something worth watching. So let's turn to the DOL fiduciary rule. It has been a very active past few months. Here are some of the highlights. On July 6th, the DOL publishes an RFI in which it not only sought comments on an extension of the transition period, but also on whether it would be appropriate to adopt an additional, more streamlined exemption to incentivize prize innovations that mitigate and even eliminate conflicts of interest and/or enhance transparency. Early August, the DOL issued supplemental guidance addressing 40B2 disclosures in light of the fiduciary rule and some clarification of the rule with respect to recommendations to increase client contributions. August 30th, the DOL issued another temporary enforcement policy, this time to address the conditions in the BIC and principal transactions exemptions that would bar a contract from containing a provision that would waive or qualify the investor's right to bring or participate in a class action. I think we can all agree that this condition of the exemptions will not make the final cut, in all likelihood. August 31st, the DOL formally proposes an 18-month delay, extending the transition sunset from January 1st, 2018 to July 1, 2019. So let's focus on the recent proposed extension of the transition period by the DOL. The proposal, if adopted, would delay the transition period by 18 months. This means that those financial institutions relying on the BIC exemption, for example, would only need to comply with the impartial conduct standards until July 1, 2019. This is great news for many because, as you know, some of the really costly aspects of the BIC exemption, such as the website build-out and the contract requirement, are deferred until lease. Let me stress something, though. The rule itself which determines whether one is a fiduciary in the first place, is well in effect and has been since June. That is not subject to this delay, which means that you currently need to ascertain whether communications you have with a plan fiduciary, such as an investment manager or an investment committee, communications with a plan participant or with an IRA holder, give rise to recommendations under the DOL rule. If they do, then we still need to figure out a way to either prevent them from creating a fiduciary relationship or have an exemption strategy in place. Is that exemption strategy that is implicated by the proposed delay? I spoke at two conferences last week, and this question is still being asked, so I felt compelled to clarify the issue today. The proposed delay, which should be finalized in the near future, only pertains to some of the more controversial conditions to the exemptions, such as the best interest contract exemption. So while an 18-month delay of the full BIC sounds nice, I do think much more work needs to be done during this transition period. The DOL still expects financial institutions to adopt such policies and procedures as they reasonably conclude are necessary to ensure that advisors comply with the impartial conduct standards. In doing so, the DOL allows for financial institutions to be flexible in how they approach these policies and procedures to the extent they have or need them, whether that is by focusing on compensation, enhancing surveillance, or some other approach. This flexibility, coupled with the DOL's compliance-first approach, rather than enforcement, create favorable conditions. Yet, the good faith effort requirement to comply with the impartial conduct standards takes time and capital. For those of you who have to comply with the impartial conduct standards, you'll have to see how the best interest determination and internal documentation goes for you. How specific do you want to be? Do you have someone at the firm audit these best interest determinations for conformance with the rule? What percentage of those determinations would be subject to that audit? Though technology solutions have helped with the best interest determination, there's still a bit of variance, and I don't think a best practice has emerged quite yet. Separately, have you fully considered whether your service offerings could fall outside the scope of the rule? There's the education exception, which can be very helpful, but one of the most popular, if not misunderstood, exceptions is the independent fiduciary exception. While this is a helpful tool, it is not a cure-all. The exception is designed to apply to arm's-length transactions where incidental recommendations are made. In other words, you can't use it if you're actually supposed to be providing investment advice. Also, the recipients of those communications cannot be retail investors. While the status of a plan participant as a retail investor should not surprise anyone, the status of a plan investment committee as one can be, depending on the circumstances, a retail investor, which could surprise many. The facts and circumstances test for that one. To the extent the marketing of your services and products may be directed to institutional investors, this exception could be quite useful. But availing yourself of it will be done through documentation, in all likelihood, which you may have seen over the summer. All right, so what exactly does the DOL say in its most recent proposed extension? Beyond the delay to July 1, 2019, there are two key issues. First, the structuring of the actual delay, and two, a new exemption. And again, we are expecting some final resolution on the extension in the coming weeks. The whole point of the extension is to provide certainty and clarity to the market, and that would strongly argue for resolution not the last week of December. So we would expect that sooner than later. So let's start with the structuring aspect that the DOL is currently considering as part of a final extension of the transition period. The DOL sought comments on whether the transition delay should be a date certain, such as July 1, 2019, or whether the DOL should institute a delay that would end after a certain action is taken by the DOL, such as a delay lasting 12 months after the DOL concludes its review. As a middle ground, there is also a tiered approach, in the DOL's words, where the transition is delayed until the earlier or later of a date certain or the end of the period following the occurrence of a defined event. You can see sort of what a mess this has all become. As for whether the delay of the transition period should be a date certain, conditioned on a specified event or the earlier than later of hybrid, those three different approaches, the DOL was particularly interested in which approach would provide sufficient certainty to financial institutions and other participants who are working to comply with the full range of conditions under the relevant exemptions. So, to the extent the delay to the transition period is tied to a DOL event, then the DOL is, you know, wanted comments when the comment period was open. They want to comment on what action or event on their part should begin the period by which the end of the delay is measured. For example, would the delay be measured based on the end of the DOL's reexamination, or should it be measured on the issuance of a proposed or final exemption, or should it be conditioned on the statement that the DOL does not intend any further changes or revisions? So those are the kinds of questions the DOL is currently reviewing right now before they put out a final extension. Other major developments that came out of the proposal was what they confirmed. So one, it anticipates proposing in the near future a new and more streamlined class exemption built on innovations in the financial services industry. Second, it has not yet completed its reexamination of the rule as directed by the president, though based on its progress so far, it believes there may be evidence of less onerous alternatives to the current rule. That's a good sign, by the way. And third, it has not yet completed its review of the comment letters received in response to the RFI. So they have their plate full. Of those things, I think we can all agree that a new and more streamlined class exemption is quite exciting. The DOL, in a number of comment letters, saw a desire to package product and service developments that present fewer conflicts of interest into an easier path towards compliance. In addition, there are other issues that we should think about in terms of this new exemption. What should it look like, ideally? And how would it differ from the streamlined conditions of the BIC exemption? Would we prefer a new exemption on top of whatever they do, the BIC exemption? Or does, from a compliance standpoint, this start to look like a number of band-aids covering structural issues? We'll have to wait and see. They're going to propose a new exemption that they confirmed. It'll go through notice and comment period, and there'll be a final one rolled out to the extent they decide to move forward. Also, what do we want in terms of SEC DOL coordination? Assuming the SEC moves forward, its new standard is just that, a standard of care. It does nothing for the privy transactions under Section 406 of ERISA or Section 4975 of the Internal Revenue Code. Should the DOL propose new exemptive relief if the financial institution adheres to a uniform standard? In fact, this is the approach that the PASS Act is taking. Yet another challenge is simply being aware of and synthesizing the DOL FAQs. There have been two batches in the transition period alone. Take, for example, the recent DOL guidance on 40B2 disclosures. So those firms that became fiduciaries by virtue of the fiduciary rule on June 9th at 11:59 p.m., there was an existing obligation under Section 40B2 to disclose fiduciary status. The DOL said in this supplemental batch of guidance, in part, that a service provider who does not reasonably and in good faith believe, okay, that it will be providing services to an ERISA plan that would make it an investment advice fiduciary under the fiduciary rule, then it would need not disclose its fiduciary status in a 40B2 disclosure, even if on occasion some reps, agents, or employees inadvertently make recommendations. But as we pointed out in a client alert, belief, you know, intent is not a basis for fiduciary status. It's not determinative. So it is possible that one can be a fiduciary under the rule, but not have to disclose its status as such for B2 purposes. Now, For those who do reasonably expect to become investment advice fiduciaries, and during 2017, the 40B2 disclosures do not need to state that they are acting in a fiduciary capacity, but rather the disclosures would simply need to describe the services that are being provided as soon as reasonably practicable. So from your standpoint, it would be important to pull the service contracts and check whether it says or somehow implies that the service provider is not acting in a fiduciary capacity, because, you know, before the fiduciary rule came into effect, you know, you were not. But those, you would have to amend those statements. They'd have to be affirmatively corrected. You can't just let them sit there. Now, what that means is, from a client relations standpoint, you'd be basically going to your plan client, doing two things. You'd be amending your service contract, deleting a statement saying that you're not a fiduciary, and you're saying, then you're going to be saying, in combination, well, here's our new 40B2 disclosure. Fiduciary status, again, can be silent, but you just need to, you know, describe your services. And that can be a bit confusing, and it's a bit disjointed there. So that's the latest guidance on 40B2. So let me just quickly summarize, because we're just about out of time. We're looking at a delay until July 1, 2019, of the transition period. During that time, we can expect a newly formed exemption and at least proposed changes to the fiduciary rule and the related exemptions. Also during this time, the DOL will continue to expect refinements to the compliance procedures aimed at satisfying impartial conduct standards. And we'll have to see what happens. I do think that the administration will continue reviewing the rule, even if Preston is not confirmed for several months. I don't think that's going to hold it up. And I do think it's worth closely following the SEC. Again, if you have any questions or you want to discuss with more fully, please feel free to reach out to us. Larry, perhaps I can hand it off to you to make any final comments today.
Yeah, I mean, I think in closing, a couple things. One, first of all, I think that there's going to be continued uncertainty for a while in this area. We've got a number of moving parts, and it's probably for the best that adequate time be taken to kind of integrate and understand what they all are. So I wouldn't expect that there'd be immediate action forthcoming in the areas we're talking about here. Secondly, it is interesting, which is that there are a lot of moving parts, and those parts include, as we talked about today, at the federal level, we've got the SEC, Department of Labor. In the case of broker deals, we have FINRA, and then we have all the states. And each of them is taking a look at what their regulatory obligations are, of their constituencies, and trying to figure out how they fit into the whole regulatory puzzle here. And in order to understand where we come from and where we're going, I think it's really important that we, you know, that us and our clients understand all of those moving parts and how they fit together.
Well, thank you, and thank you everyone for joining us today. Thank you.
Today's conference, thank you for your participation. You may now hang up.